Welcome. This is the Interpreter Foundation Roundtable on Gospel Doctrine, the Book of Mormon, lesson number 31. Sorry, I'm sitting here trying to click over to the title. Firm in the Faith of Christ. I'm Bruce Webster. With me is Martin Tanner. We certainly have done a number of these together before and probably will again later. Anyway, the lesson today is covering the first half of the war chapters in the Book of Alma, chapters 43 through 52. The classic question is always, and I got this as a freshman in my Honors Book of Mormon class from Chauncey Riddle, who's dean of the graduate school. He assigned us to say, why did Mormon include 20 chapters of war in putting together the Book of Mormon? Hopefully between this and Lesson 32, we can suggest some answers to that. But the setting here is we've just finished all the missionary work. There's been this great division. You've had some dissenters from the Nephites, particularly the Zoramites, go over among the Lamanites. We've had the anti-Nephi Lehites come over to the Nephites and become the people of Ammon. Alma has given this counsel to his three sons, and this is sort of the long drawing in of breath before the storm breaks upon what's going to be happening for the next really about 100 years. It's going to be a series of conflicts. There'll be periods of peace there, but things are in essence going to start going. Are going to be rough and are going to start going downhill for the next 100 years until we end up with the Savior's coming. Or actually, the Savior's death in 3 Nephi 8, followed by his visiting. So, Alma, we're covering Alma 43 through 52. There's really sort of an initial segment here where we've got one invasion by the Lamanites. Then we've got a internal civil war over rulership among the Nephites. The loser goes off to the Lamanites, stirs them up to battle, and then we come up with the prolonged war between the Lamanite and Nephite nations. So let's go to Alma 43 and see what's happening here. The lesson actually picks up a little later into 43. But I've always liked verse 1. This is immediately following Alma's counsel to his three sons. Verse 1 says, "And now it came to pass that the sons of Alma did go forth among the people to declare the word unto them." So it sounds like Coriantumr repented and got with the program as well. "And Alma also himself could not rest and went forth." So there's trying to strengthen the church. And now Mormon in 3 says, "Now I return to an account of the wars starting in the 18th year of the reign of the judges." We have, as I said, the Zoramites, where Alma, with this dream team of missionaries, was preaching. They basically have thrown themselves in politically and militarily with Lamanites, except for the people they kicked out who went and moved in with the people of Ammon. And it's the dissenters. It's the Zoramites. It's the Amalekites. It's the descendants of the priests of Noah who are basically stirring up this battle. And we have a Lamanite battle by the head of headed by Zerahemnah, who's going to come down, and they have it in especially for the people of Ammon, the anti-Nephi Lehi. So he's going to lead these Lamanites down basically to punish the people of Ammon, which include the anti-Nephi Lehis, and also include, remember, the people who accepted Alma and the missionaries in the among the Zoramites and got kicked out. So that they see them both as sort of traitors or dissenters from their own particular culture, and their intent is to wipe them out. So that's where we pick up through here, and I'll throw it over to Martin.
These are some amazing chapters. as Bruce mentioned, they deal mainly with wars. And wars not just for the sake of wars, but discussing, especially here in chapter 43, the motivation behind these particular wars. For example, in verse 7, it talks about Zarahemla's motives behind this. Why is he stirring up this war? Why is he going to make it happen? To preserve hatred towards the Nephites so that he can bring them into subjugation or subjection to the accomplishments of his designs. Basically, he wants to cause them grief. He wants to kill them. He wants to be in political charge of everyone and to his increase his power. That's his motivation. And then you take a look at verse 9 and you see juxtaposed against that the motivation of the Nephites. Now, the design of the Nephites was to support their lands and their houses and their wives and their children, that they might preserve them from the hands of their enemies, and that they might preserve their rights and privileges, their liberty, that they might worship God according to their desires. And so you see here that the motivation is described in these chapters as being wicked on the one hand by Zarahemla and those who are following him, and righteous on the other hand by the Nephites. And one of the things that's fascinating as we go through these chapters is we see how motivation affects someone's performance. And that to me has always been a fascinating thing. There have been times when I have been involved in debates against critics of the church, and rather than worry about them, I've always thought to myself, you know, I have kind of an unfair advantage here. I actually have the truth on my side. And that's just kind of the way I look at it. And that seems to be the way that it's being described in these chapters. The righteous people are supported by God. In a war context, this is a little bit similar to the peacetime context that we hear over and over again about keeping commandments and prospering in the land. Two other quick background points here. In verse 11, it mentions the people of Anti-Nephi Lehi. And of course, they're described elsewhere earlier, but this shows pretty clearly that Anti-Nephi Lehites were people who were from this place, Anti-Nephi Lehi, that this is not some designation. I suppose it could be, but the context here makes it very, very much look like this is strictly geographical. And of course, we have other reasons to believe that earlier as well. And another fascinating point here, which I am struck by every time I read through these chapters, is that if Joseph Smith had been making up this information here and using the Native Americans about which he was familiar, he would have described Native Americans very much different from the ones that are described, particularly starting in verse 18 here, in terms of their weapons of war and their garb. You see the descriptions here in verse 18, swords and scimitars. Scimitar, of course, is the curved-bladed Middle Eastern-style sword. No one in Joseph Smith's area would have known of Native Americans using swords unless they had borrowed them from Western peoples, and especially not scimitars. These were Middle Eastern weapons of war, and yet those weapons are found in Mesoamerica, in a place that Joseph Smith would have known nothing about. And you go on in verse 19, and you have the same kind of a thing. Breastplates, arm shields, shields to defend their heads. He doesn't quite say helmets. He says shields to defend their heads, and thick clothing, something like body armor or something along those lines. These are things that, and the word armor is specifically used in verse 21 with breastplates and shields. These are descriptions of clothing and weapons of war that would not have been descriptions Joseph Smith would have used absent revelation. And these are the very things that were used in wars in Central America centuries ago. And you can find them depicted in Mayan calendars, which have accompanying them some amazing artwork, and in temples from that area. These descriptions ring true and are not anything that Joseph Smith could possibly have known about. And every time I read through this, I'm absolutely in awe of what he says, because it's right on the mark and he could not have known it. And another point here that's mentioned is another point that's mentioned here that's fascinating to me is the River Sidon in verse 22. This and several other ones make it a place that is up and located in the south, which also only fits the geography of Mesoamerica. And so that's not something Joseph Smith would have known. He probably didn't even pick that up as he was translating all this, although that's conjecture. And we also read here in verse 16, the name Moroni. This is the first time he appears in chapter 43, verse 16, and we've set things up here for the first war, which is quite a tremendous clash here. And I suppose at that point I'll toss it back to you, Bruce.
Okay. Just a couple things I'd like to point out. And first is something that we've said repeatedly in these roundtables, but it's worth pointing out again. I recall a woman that I home taught about 25 years ago, who's struggling with the church and her testimony and talking about the Book of Mormon. She says, oh, it's all just, you know, good guys versus bad guys and cowboys and Indians. And I said, no, actually, it's far more complicated and sophisticated than that. And one of the common misperceptions by regular members of the church is that the Lamanite divide was somehow racial. Of course, first, that's sort of silly because they're actually, it's kind of like saying the divide between Jews and Arabs is racial when they both trace back to Abraham. It's the same thing. Nephites and Lamanites both just, you know, were descendants of Lehi and those who they found when they arrived in the New World. But what becomes very clear relatively early, well before this point, but it's reiterated here, is that for the purposes of Mormon's abridgment, the terms Nephite and Lamanite are cultural and political terms. It's a bit like if we go back to World War II. Let's say it's, you know, Americans fighting Germans, and you say, well, you know, this is obviously a racial divide between Americans and Germans. Well, you have this great melting pot in America, and frankly, you had a, you know, decent, if not big, melting pot in Germany, though of course one of their big things was racial purity there. And of course, you had lots of people in America who were frankly of German descent. It's the same thing here. If you look at verse 13, it says that the Nephites were compelled to withstand against Lamanites, who were a compound of Laman and Lemuel and the sons of Ishmael, meaning the descendants of those families, and all those who had descended from the Nephites, who were Amalekites and Zoramites and the descendants of the priest of Noah. Now those descendants, and I think he's talking about more than just the descendants of the priests of Noah. I think he's lumping the Amalekites and Zoramites in there as well. He says those descendants were numerous nearly as were the Nephites. Thus the Nephites were obliged to contend with their brethren even into bloodshed. You had the quote Lamanite Empire had a very large Nephite population in it. And frankly, it was that population, and we'll see this through these chapters, it's that Nephite population that is causing the war. They want to come back, as Martin said, they want to conquer the Nephites, and they want to rule over the Lamanites and over the Nephites as well. One other small point here, because we've got a lot of chapters to cover. This is 29 and 30 is a little interesting passage here because Moroni says he knows it was the intention of the Nephites to destroy their brethren or to subject them, bring them into bondage. And also he knowing that it was the only desire of the Nephites to preserve their lands, their liberties, and their churches. Therefore, he thought it no sin that he should defend them by stratagem, meaning by using espionage and intelligence and so on. Now, for us, we might say, why is he even worried about that? But if you get to a pre-Columbian ancient civilization mindset, battles were very ritualistic. You set a time and a place. I think Stephen Smoot says in one of the roundtables, you know, it was sort of our God versus your God, and you'll see the religious elements in these chapters. But it was typically you set up a time and a place and agreed to meet and you came to battle. And the idea was that the side who had right on their side or whose God was more powerful would win. Moroni here is deciding, well, you know, rather than meet in open battle, let's find out what they're doing and we're going to ambush them. And we're justified in doing this because they're trying to destroy us and we're not trying to conquer them. Moroni sees this as purely a defensive war and treats it as purely a defensive war. But he sees nothing inappropriate in using, Sun Tzu says, you know, all warfare is based on deceit. He sees nothing inappropriate in trying to gain an advantage over the Lamanites by spying on them, by figuring out where they're going to go and then attacking them. Which is what he does here. He figures out where the Lamanites are going to go. And actually, what he does is he goes to Alma. Says, you know, Alma's head of the church. Says, Alma, can you tell me what's going to happen here? And Alma prays, and it says the word of the Lord came into Alma, and Alma told the messengers of Moroni that the attack was going to come around Manti, which is up near the headwaters of the River Sidon. And so Alma or Moroni marches his forces over there and manages to ambush them as they're approaching the river. Now, this gets us to another thing. I study a fair amount of military history. There are some remarkably smart military moves that are made here. And if you're talking ancient combat, one of the classic ones is to trap your enemy in a river. It's hard to move in a river. You can't move fast. You can't dodge out of the way. And so the idea is that you want to, you know, wait until your enemy is crossing the river, attack them there, and if possible, attack them from both sides, which is what we see described here. But even with that, we have... The Lamanites fight fiercely, and again, we have a relatively even-handed portrayal of the strengths and weaknesses of the two sides. And actually, the Nephites are in the on the verge of turning tail, and Moroni encourages them. They win the day, and then something very interesting happens. Says they've got them surrounded. They're on both sides. The Lamanites are trapped in the river, or in and around the river and its banks. They're in the worst possible strategic position. And Moroni stops attacking. He calls off the attack immediately. Or rather, commands his men to stop killing the Lamanites. And then we go into chapter 44. And you have this interchange between Moroni and Zerahemnah, where Moroni says, leave us alone, but you know, we want you to surrender your weapons of war, which is basically it's a forced disarmament, which is going to mean it's going to be hard for Zerahemnah to simply sneak around another way and carry out another attack if they've had to surrender all their weapons of war, and swear an oath that you're not going to come against us. It's very interesting because Zerahemnah says, well, I'll give you our weapons, but we're not going to swear an oath because we still want to plan to kill you. And you have this very strong religious undertones. You know, Zerahemnah says, we don't believe what you believe. There's a very religious component to these wars. And Moroni basically says, look, I'm not taking my word back. You're going to have to swear the oath or we're going to kill you right here. And with that, I'll throw it into Martin's lap.
and this is fascinating too. People often say, wow, wait a minute, you know, swear oaths in war and talk about different rules. But you know, Bruce mentioned that there were rules of war in the past. We still have some of those today. People talk all the time about the Geneva Convention and and in the not so distant past, one of the most fascinating but tragic war movies of the last 50 years or so is the Bridge Over the River Kwai, and you have these British soldiers who are just intent about obeying the rules and making sure that the Geneva Convention is adhered to, and they're Japanese captors who were running this prison camp that they're in are only following the rules if it will really serve their purposes, and they don't if it's not. And you have similar kinds of things that happen at various points in the Revolutionary War between the United States and Britain. The British leaders were forever complaining that the Americans were just not adhering to those standards of war, which all dignified gentlemen should follow. And that was a huge problem for them. And so rules of war and exactly what they are things that live with us to this day. And so these descriptions ring very, very, very true. The fascinating part about we will not take an oath is that he flat out says that. Now this is Zerahemnah is the bad guy. And you say to yourself, why didn't he just say, sure, we'll take it, and then he would break it. But he still has enough integrity so that rather than take an oath and deliberately break it, he'll just flat out say up front, we're not going to do it because we wouldn't live by it if we did. So we're just not going to take this oath. And that to me is one of the fascinating things, that the idea of oaths and promises and how important they are ingrained in this culture, perhaps more than they are in ours, where we have to have all these written contracts for every little detail when you have agreements. Even the bad guy in chapter 44 is honest enough, if you will, so that even though we would say he's on the bad side, he won't take an oath because he knows he's going to break it, and he's just flat out honest about that, which to me is fascinating, and also something that we would not see here if this were a reflection of our culture, Joseph Smith's culture of his time. We also have a fascinating reference to things that Joseph Smith would have known about in his era, but which we also find in Mesoamerica, which is in verses 12 and 13, the idea of taking a scalp. We have this fascinating and yet a little bit gruesome way that one shows what they've accomplished in war. Maybe they've moved on a little bit and they thought, wow, you know, if we have these scalps, it's a little less cumbersome than gathering up a whole batch of arms and hauling them around. You know, scalps are a little bit lighter. Who knows? But this is a fascinating little reference of war here. One of the other geographic points that I wanted to mention is in chapter 44, verse 22, where it says, they cast their dead into the waters of Sidon, and they have gone forth and are buried in the depths of the sea. So from wherever they were tossed, the river Sidon here empties out into a great sea. I suppose I'll leave it there for chapter 44. We have a lot to cover.
Yeah, one other point here is that Zarahemla is very angry, and this is after he gets part of his scalp cut off, and they start attacking the Nephites again. Of course, they're surrounded. They're in a very bad situation. Again, they're in, imagine sort of a broad valley with a river in the middle, but slopes, gentle slopes going up on either side, and the Lamanites are congregated in and around the river, and you have two Nephite armies on either side. It's one of the worst positions you can be in tactically. And then you have the Nephite advantage. The Nephites have this thick clothing. They've got the breastplates, the plates on the head. They've frankly got better weapons. And the Lamanites start fighting. They start getting slaughtered again. And what's interesting is Zarahemla cries out, calls it to a stop, and says, okay, I'll take the oath. I'll take the oath. We'll give you our weapons. I'll take the oath. Let us go in peace. And here's what's interesting. They take the weapons. You know, Zarahemla and his forces who have survived take the oath. They leave, and you never hear of Zarahemla again. He does not show up in any of the – I mean, there will be additional battles between over the next – 12 years or so between the Nephites and Lamanites, and you never hear Zarahemla's name again. Now, it could be that he was executed for losing the battle or whatever, or it could simply be that he chose to live up to his oath, having sworn it once, and left it to others to carry the fight to the Nephites.
Great point, and I think your latter interpretation is right, because he respects oaths and covenants, even as we read earlier and mentioned in verse 8. So I think you're right on the mark there, Bruce.
Okay, chapter 45 starts with Alma giving some counsel to his son Helaman. And there's an interesting thing here. There's actually, this is from the plates. We don't often realize the Book of Alma is actually two books. It's the book. There's a Book of Alma and a Book of Helaman in it, but you don't have a. There wasn't a separate title for the Book of Helaman. Instead of off the plates, because it's on the manuscript, you have this little paragraph that says the account of the people of Nephi, and their wars and dissensions in the days of Helaman, according to the record of Helaman, which he kept in his days. So the Book of Alma comprises both the record of Alma and the record of his son Helaman. Our book of Helaman is going to be the record of Helaman's son Helaman. So this is the start of what's really a new book. It starts with Alma's charge to Helaman. And then we have this one of the little intriguing mysteries. There are a number of just very intriguing little mysteries in the Book of Mormon. And it's as a writer, it's to me a sign of authenticity because not everything is explained. It's not necessarily a gap. It's just things happen and you never quite learn exactly what the answer is. We have verses 18 and 19 that Alma departs out of the land of Zarahemla as if to go to the land of Melech, and he vanishes. And they don't know if he died. They don't know if he's translated. They don't know if he's buried by the hand of the Lord. And says, you know, for this we know nothing of his death and burial. We actually don't know, and we never learn what happened to Alma. He simply vanishes while traveling from one city to another. And what we have then is Helaman and his brethren go forth to try and this is a constant theme, they're trying to put the church back in order. They go through the land trying to reestablish it. But it says that there arose a dissension among them, and they would not give heed to the words of Helaman and his brethren. But they grew proud, being lifted up their hearts because of their exceedingly great riches. Therefore, they grew rich in their own eyes. Interesting phrase. They were rich in their own eyes, and they would not give heed to their words, meaning the words of Helaman and his brethren, to walk uprightly before God. This is basically laying the ground for the next set of chapters, because what the Book of Mormon actually, if you read it carefully, as long as the Nephites as a whole are living up to their covenants and doing the right things, they're not attacked. It's when there is sufficient wickedness and self-indulgence among the Nephites that all the way back to what the Lord told Lehi and Nephi, that, you know, the seed of thy brethren shall be as a scourge to stir them up to remembrance. And that's a lot of what we're going to see in these war chapters. The Nephites are getting rich and proud, and they're sowing the seeds of their own painful wars here. And that's what I've got for 45. Do you have anything to add there?
Just one quick thing, and that is that if we take a look at verse 19, Helaman obviously has great regard for Alma because he compares him to Moses, as Bruce was peripherally referring to earlier. And even though he really doesn't know what happened to him, as Bruce pointed out, the specific statement here is that we suppose that he also received Alma. He, the Lord, also received Alma in the spirit, just like happened to Moses. That's the gist of what's being said here. So Helaman has great regard for Alma, describing him the same way that he describes Moses, which is a tremendous tribute. That's all I have for 45.
Okay, 46. We have this Nephite civil war, and that's what, and this is going to lead to the wars between the Lamanites and the Nephites. And it is once again, This constant tension ever since Mosiah abdicated and dissolved the kingship. We've had this constant tension of those who want to reinstitute a kingship among the Nephites and those who want to preserve their freedom, at least as they see it. And so we have Amalekiah, my gosh. Machiavelli doesn't have much on Amalekiah. The next few chapters read like a 21st century political novel. The manipulations and the machinations that Amalekiah goes through to bring about what he wants are remarkably clever and sophisticated. And once again, it's the answer of how could a New York farm boy, a young one at that, you know, relatively young farm man, I should say, but how can a young man, a farmer, not much education, come up with this incredibly complex and sophisticated set of steps that Amalickiah does to, in essence, over the next couple chapters, to leverage himself into the kingship and to turn around to use the Lamanites to carry out what he failed to do among the Nephites, which is go back and try to conquer the Nephites. And again, you've got in verses 8 and 9, thus we see how quick the children of men do forget the Lord of their God, yea, how quick to do iniquity and to be led away by the evil one. Yea, and we also see the great wickedness one very wicked man can cause take place among the children of men. That's Mormon talking, and those are two of his most important points that he makes time and again in the Book of Mormon. The influence, the evil that a wicked leader can cause, can bring to pass, and how quickly, when things are going well, that we tend to forget God and, you know, turn again to be led away by the evil one. Martin.
These chapters are phenomenal, and it is so true here that one bad person can create so many horrible things in a country or even in the world, and we could come up with examples. On the other hand, one good person can create so much good in the world if they are followed by others. This is fascinating to me, and I love the descriptions very, very much. These are the famous chapters that talk about the title of liberty, and again, we should not be troubled by, here we are about 73 BC, about descriptions in verses 13 and 16 of Christians before the time of Christ. Why? Because this is a translation in the early 1800s, and the language was used when Joseph Smith did the translation that would best convey the meaning to us now. These were people who were followers of the coming Messiah, and they, to us, looked like Christians, and so that's the best description for them. And so I wondered about these references in the Book of Mormon for a long time, and then actually had a brief discussion with Hugh Nibley many, many, many years ago, in which he kind of smiled when I brought up this issue after a little speech he did at a seminar, and said, "Well, what do you think a translation is? Translation, putting something into your own words that best conveys the meaning. What's wrong with this?" You know, and he just kind of just laid it all right out there, and it made perfect sense to me. And so let your heart not be troubled if you've pondered on that issue. Most of you probably haven't. One of the other fascinating things here is that this title of liberty in verse 13 is put up on the top of a pole. This is something that is described, people would not quite do this today. If this is not quite a flag, because something's written on it, and so it's not described as a flag. But it kind of looks like a flag. It's up on a pole, and it gives people great meaning. And so this was probably some kind of a custom. It doesn't say, and a brand new thing was done here, and something was written and held up on a pole. It describes quite matter-of-factly how this took place, and that it was placed up on a pole. And the idea here that has always been conveyed, to me anyway, is that this is a custom or a tradition amongst these people that's different from what we do, but that makes complete sense and is similar to things that we do, but different enough so it needed to be described in detail. And I love the details here. They're fascinating. And they serve a great purpose because they engender things like patriotism and allegiance to good things and the desire to fight for what is moral and right and good, those kinds of things. And again, a fascinating description here that Joseph Smith just never would have come up with on his own. Beautiful. Standard of Liberty, verses 12 and 13. Back to you.
Yeah, two things. First, as a follow-up to that, in non-modern warfare, and even to extent, and Joseph may have been aware of this because the Bible makes reference to standard bearers, but the idea of a banner or a standard is that it's where you rally the troops. They can tell where the leader is, and particularly when you've got in ancient warfare, you would have different groupings of different types of soldiers, or they were fighting as a particular unit, subunit within their army. And by looking for the standard, they could rally to that. They could see where their leader was. Indeed, our game of capture the flag, the idea is to take the other side's standard. So this was a concept that, and I believe someone, I'm sorry I don't have a citation for you, but I'm pretty sure an LDS scholar has published something recently, it may have been Brant Gardner, on apparent use of banners and standards among Mesoamerican civilizations pre-Columbus. So you've got that, and then you've got here this little passing reference about the part of the remnant of the coat of Joseph had been preserved and not decayed. There's nothing about that in the Bible. But there is a lot about that in Jewish and Arabic writings about Joseph. There are actually two portions of Joseph's garment. There was a portion with blood on it that his brothers brought back to Jacob to deceive him as far as what had happened to Joseph. And then there was another portion that was preserved that Joseph had preserved, and that this ties into a lot of the Jewish legends about the garment of Adam and so on. It was actually a sign that Joseph's brothers, on returning to Israel from being in Egypt, took back this portion of garment to prove to their father that Joseph was still alive. So you have this story which comes out of nowhere here, and saying, even as the remnant of the garment of Joseph was preserved, so let us, you know, a remnant of the seed of my son be preserved by the hand of God. He's quoting Jacob here, and he's basically saying, look, we know we're descended from Joseph. Who knows but we're that remnant, therefore we need to fight to preserve ourselves. And this is still civil war here. This is not Lamanites versus Nephites. This is Nephites versus Nephites. Moroni prevails. Amalickiah and a small band flee to the Lamanites. And then we once again begin to have peace in the land for the space of 4 years. There's a little breathing space here. And then there's one other interesting note, and this ties into some of the things that Martin has been bringing up. Verse 40. Saying there are some who died for fevers, which at some seasons of the year were very frequent in the land, but not so much with fevers, because the excellent plants and roots which God had prepared to remove the causes of diseases to which men were subject by the nature of the climate. Okay, I've mentioned before, I served in Central America. This is land, you know, the tropics are an area where there are a lot of diseases that humans are subject to, and particularly diseases causing fevers, most notably malaria, but other ones as well. This makes it sound like they are in a tropical or semi-tropical climate. So there's a minor point, and I think, unless you've got something more, we can move on to 47.
I have one real quick thing about 46, and that is, well, first of all, say right on the mark, thank you for bringing up the fevers and plants. Absolutely true. I wanted to add one thing about the coat of Joseph. It's fascinating to me here, and I really like that this is described as the coat of Joseph, but of course, since this is a revealed document by Revelation, Joseph doesn't fall into the trap of describing this as a coat of many colors. And Nibley points out, and I've tried to research and do due diligence on what he said, just to verify it, that the idea of coat of many colors that you see in the King James Version and others is really not a good translation. And there are a lot of modern translations where you read it and there's this little asterisk, you know, the New Revised Standard Version and the Contemporary English Version, where you have this little asterisk and it pulls you down and it says, in effect, gee, we really don't know exactly what this means. It could mean coat of many colors. It could also mean powers, or it could have reference. And it just kind of goes on with some vague comments, but it really doesn't tell you because they just don't know. And Nibley's comment, which to me makes perfect sense, is that Joseph's coat was a priesthood garment, and it had marks on it or inscriptions on it or something on it that designated it as a priesthood garment. And that would also explain why it was preserved, and it would also explain why it was revered for so long and why it's brought up again here in connection with the righteousness of the people who are following Moroni, who are the seed of Jacob. And that's all I have for 46.
Yep. Okay, let's go on to 47. 47 is the... It's make a great novel nowadays. It's a political thriller. It's Malachi. Stop and think. Malachi has been defeated in his effort to overthrow the Nephite government. He flees with a small band among the Lamanites, and he works his way into the kingship. And he does it by very devious means. This is a remarkably clever and cynical approach that he takes. Like I said, Machiavelli's got nothing on him. Where basically he basically stirs up the Lamanites to anger against the Nephites. Lamanites at this point are like, you know, we've lost the last several battles. We don't want to go against them. And so Malachi gets the king to proclaim that, no, you need to go against them. And part of the army flees, and Malachi goes to basically make treaty with the part of the army that had fled. And the leader of that part of the army is absolutely paranoid, doesn't want to meet with him. And the Malachi solution, this is a very clever solution. He says, hey, I'll tell you what. Here's what's going to happen. We'll camp at the base of the hill of where you're camped, and you come down and surround us, and we'll surrender to you. And Lahonti, who's the leader of this other group of Lamanites, says, well, okay, that sounds great, and he does it. So now you've got these two portions of the Lamanite army that have merged together. Lahonti is the leader of the army, and Amalekai becomes the second in command. And then Amalekai poisons him and takes over the army. And now Amalekai has got the what appears to be the largest single armed force among the Lamanites under his command. And he marches towards the capital city to meet with the king. He sends his servants ahead. And again, this is like out of a modern thriller. This group of servants of Amalekai come up. They bow before the king. The king reaches down to lift them up, which is a classic ancient sign of, you know, you bow at respect and you wait for the king to lift you up. Frankly, I think the same thing is practiced under certain circumstances in being presented to the king and queen of England. And when the king reaches down, one of the servants of Amalekai jumps up and stabs him to death, and then they immediately accuse the king's servants of having slain him. And start the hue and cry. And the king's servants are like, we're in big trouble. And they run off. And Amalekai says, oh, this is horrible. Who's done this? You know, I'm sending a group off to kill these awful servants. And then he goes in and comforts the queen and reassures her. The queen is kind of like, okay, what's happening here? My husband just got killed. Amalekai is here. I'm told the king's servants did it. And you have Amalekai who comforts the queen and basically convinces her to marry him, and he becomes king. The king's servants, in the meanwhile, set off for Nephite territory because they know there's no place safe for them. They know exactly what's happened. And that actually raises a very interesting question. One of the things that's most fascinating about the Book of Mormon is that it does not describe things that you don't know about. It's very careful narrative. There's no omniscient third person here. If there are things going on that there's no one to have conveyed that information, you just don't know about it. So we have this whole complicated thing where apparently we do know what Amalekai is doing, but we have two sources of information. First, the king's servants who were there when the king was killed run off to the Nephites. And what we're going to learn about 15 chapters from now is that one of Amalekiah's servants goes over to the Nephites, which is probably the source of this detailed information of what happened. But this is treachery. This is clever. This smacks of the most manipulative ancient politics and warfare. It rings so true to nature. And, you know, once again, it's like, how would a 23-year-old Joseph have made this up? This was a very, and the whole story is told in the space of one chapter here, a relative handful of verses. It is a remarkable bit of narrative history that rings very, very true, to us who have a greater understanding of, just how dirty politics and warfare can be, and particularly in ancient civilizations. Martin, over to you.
Thanks. It is amazing, Bruce, how, as you say, how horrible and evil this guy is. Leads the other commander in the army to believe he's a buddy, poisons him, has his servants go bump off the king, claims it's the king's men, basically convinces the king's wife to marry him, and proclaims himself to be the king. And he thought of all this up front, according to verse 16. You know, what a horrible, evil, awful, slimy guy. I mean, this is about as bad as someone could be. And he gets away with it. And this is the point in time where you start to see how in an evil society or a society filled with a number of people who are evil, how evil, certain elements of evil can preside over other evil elements, because you don't have any real good guys here. I shouldn't say you don't have any at all, but you have bad guys and worse guys, and Amalekiah sort of takes over the bad guys because he's even worse, and then he goes after the Lamanites. It's like a bad movie where you don't have the good guys, you just have the bad guys and the worst guys, and it's really kind of sad when you look at it that way. That's all I have for 47.
Okay. Mormon can't resist one of his editorial comments here. He points out the fact that this is all pretty much being run by Nephite dissenters. And it's very fascinating what he says. In 36, he says, now these dissenters, meaning people like Amalekiah and so on, having the same instruction and the same information of the Nephites, yea, having been instructed in the same knowledge of the Lord, nevertheless, it is strange to relate, not long after their dissensions, they become more hardened and impenitent and more wild, wicked, and ferocious than the Lamanites, drinking in with all the traditions of the Lamanites, giving way to indolence and all manners of lasciviousness, yea, entirely forgetting the Lord their God. It's basically saying Nephite dissenters were frankly veering off much farther from the commandments of God than the Lamanites themselves were. Anyway, so that's, with that, we'll go to 48, and I'll throw this into, since I went on a length about 47, I'll throw this over to you, Martin, chapter 48.
All right, I'm going to be very brief here on out in the interest of time. Chapter 48 has some wonderful things in here, and again, in contrast to the last chapter where you see all the horrible things by stratagem that Amalekiah can do. Here you see the other side of things. Verse 7 says, now it came to pass that while Amalekiah had thus been obtaining power by fraud and deceit, Mormon, on the other hand, had been preparing the minds of the people to be faithful unto the Lord their God. That's kind of the summary of the whole background here. And we are left as readers to say to ourselves, yeah, I want to be on that good guy's side. I want to be on Moroni's side. And then it goes on and describes all the things that he did. And of course, we have, Bruce brought up the wonderful thing about climate. Here's another one in verse 8 talking about building great walls of stone and cities and things that you would never find in North America done by the Native Americans. You do have walled cities and cities of stone and banks in Central America. So verse 8 is something that would support a Mesoamerican view of the Book of Mormon. But aside from that little point, as you read, particularly starting in verse 10 and going on through, I guess about verse 15, you have a beautiful description of who Moroni is and who we should be and who we should emulate. Who is Moroni? He's a strong and a mighty man of perfect understanding, whose soul had joy in liberty and freedom. He's a great guy. And talks about his heart swelling with thanksgiving for privileges and blessings and welfare and safety. And he's a man who's firm in his faith in Christ. And in verse 13, this is fascinating. He had sworn an oath to defend his people. So here we have this idea of swearing an oath being something that the good guys often do. We see this over and over again. I just love these verses, chapter 48. You know what? That's enough. 48 talks about Moroni, and it talks about how good we ought to be and how we ought to be like him. Back to you.
Okay, just a couple things. The it's very interesting that what we see is actual outright propaganda. Verse 1 of 48. Malachi builds towers and has men up on the towers, inciting hatred against the Nephites. telling them, you know, all the horrible things the Nephites did, and so on and so forth. And you also have, on the other hand, towards the end of the chapter, the Nephites talking about how regretful they were that they had to contend with the Lamanites. They would just as soon leave them alone, but they were not willing to lay down their lives and let their wives and children be slaughtered. And therefore they were preparing themselves. And we're still in the 19th year, which is that this started out with the Malachi trying to take power among the Nephites. Now he sends armies down to Ammonihah. Now remember, Ammonihah, if you have, you know, roughly, and pardon me for using my hand like this, but, you know, you've got the land of Nephi, you've got a wilderness here, you've got the city of Manti, you have Sidon here. Ammonihah is up here along the western edge, and there's mountains between the Sidon River Valley and the western sea and the western shoreline. And this is why the Lamanites went up that way the first time they destroyed Ammonihah. So they decide, well, you know, we destroyed the city. It should be easy to take. And they send a army up there, and they discover it's not only been rebuilt, it's been fortified. And they're kind of like, oh, crud. We can't take this. We've never seen this kind of fortification before. There's sort of an arms race that goes on over the space of a few decades here that we're going to see back and forth in the wars here. So Moroni has built these fortified walls, and the Lamanite army is not happy with it. And it's very interesting. This is, I think, Mormon as an experienced military leader himself talking. In verse 10, he says, now if King Amalekiah were actually there with the armies, they probably would have gone ahead and attacked Ammonihah. He says, but his chief captains were like, we don't think we can do this. There's got to be easier cities. We'll go attack another city. And they swear a blood oath that they're going to attack the other cities. And they go over to the land of Noah and discovered that it's fortified too. And they try to attack. They try to climb up these walls. You've got a ditch and a wall. The Lamanites are still fighting mostly with bows and arrows and slings. And the Lamanites have a height advantage. There's a slope advantage. You have to expose yourself trying to climb up these walls. And this is verse 22, again, having studied warfare, particularly ancient warfare, verse 22 sounds very true to life. It says they're trying to dig down the banks of earth, the walls of earth, and they're getting stones and arrows coming down at them because, you know, the Nephites don't want to go down and engage them directly with swords and so on because then they'll be within reach. So imagine you've got this steep embankment here. You're trying to climb up. You're trying to tear it down. And there's this little thing saying that instead of filling up the ditches around the wall with dirt, it's filled up with their bodies. and you have a rather disastrous outcome. The chief captains, the Lamanites, are all killed, whereas not a single Nephite were slain. There were some wounded, and that's it. And then the Lamanites, who are left, flee back south along the coast, get back to Amalickiah, who is just furious beyond belief. And again, and swears to drink the blood of Moroni. You have the Nephites grateful for their deliverance. I'm sure very grateful for Moroni, but grateful to God for delivering them. And they're very happy with how things have turned out. There was a Lamanite invasion that was completely turned back without a single loss of Nephite life. And so the Nephites are feeling pretty good about themselves at this point. Chapter 15, or David, unless you've got something else, chapter 15, back to you.
I am done with chapter 49. Chapter 50 continues on with Moroni's approach to warfare. Verse 1 says, it came to pass that Moroni did not stop making preparations for war or to defend his people against the Lamanites. So we see here that he realizes that even though he has accomplished victory, he sees that it's not long term, that this is just a lull in the warfare. And so he continues with preparations. And it goes into some pretty great detail about this. Verse 2 talks about upon the tops of ridges of earth, he caused there should be timbers, works of timbers built up to the height of a man round about the cities. And upon the works of timbers, there was a frame of pickets built upon the timbers, that they were strong and high. So exactly what these pickets look like, we don't know, but these are war fortifications, and Moroni sees the writing on the wall that these kinds of things are going to continue, and he's right, because the descriptions in chapter 15 continue on with great, great battles. Skipping a bunch in the interest of time, verse 35 talks about the outcome. It says, the battle commenced between them, in the which Teancum did slay Morianton and defeat his army, took them prisoners, and returned to the camp of Moroni. And it goes on. And in verse 37 talks about the chief judge having died, and the judgment seat. Just horrible things are going on here. This is a really, really difficult time. Towards the very end of chapter 50, we have Nephiha appointed to fill the judgment seat instead of his father. And
the son of Nephiha, yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, for that correction. And so horrible times, difficult times. And then chapter 50 ends. That's all I'll say about chapter 50.
This is a 4-year period, which is all spent in preparation for the next Lamanite invasion. The war that takes place, the battle that takes place, is really, once again, an internal civil war. It's a dispute between two cities or lands that are both Nephite, Lehi and Morianton, that are disputing over some property. The people of Lehi go to Moroni. The people of Morianton sort of panic. It sounds like they may have had some Lamanite sympathies. They're basically compelled by force. Again, as Martin has said, that their leader, Morianton, ends up being killed. And the dispute is settled. But you've got this 4 years of preparation for the wars that are about to come. And Pahoran is the son of Nephiha, who's appointed to the judgment seat. Showing once again that for those who seem to think that this is a democracy, it tends to be very hereditary as far as who's the chief judge. And then once again, we start with internal conflicts in 51. We start with internal conflicts. You have, once again, a group that wants to institute a king. Now, this is a constant theme. This seems to come up about every 5 years. They want to reinstitute a kingship among the Nephites. My personal suspicion is that this is probably a faction, you know, if you recall all the way back to the Book of Omni, you had the Nephites fleeing out of the land of Nephi into the land of Zarahemla, where they found the existing, what we call the Mulekites, and which was actually the larger population. But the Nephites ended up as the ruling class. And pretty much ever since Mosiah dissolved the kingship, there has been this constant faction that has wanted to reinstall a kingship. I suspect those are probably predominantly people of Mulekite descent, because there are still descendants of Mosiah who are around, who would be the rightful Nephite rulers, but it's always these other people who want to become kings. So you have this effort to try and change the government using the political process. The majority say, no, we want to stay as what they call freemen. And this dissension comes at a time when Amalickiah is starting to sort of pick at the border, the southern borders of the Nephites, and attack them. The kingmen refuse to help as this starts to come up, and Moroni basically, with permission from Horan, institutes martial law and forces the kingmen to say, you've got to defend the country. You can't just sit on your hands. But while this is all going on, while there's this internal conflict, Amalickiah takes advantage of it and starts attacking and capturing cities. And you have basically they go particularly along the East Sea. There's a along the Eastern Seashore is where they're going to capture a number of cities, and that's where a lot of the battles are going to take place for quite some time. And the problem is, as he points out in verse 27, and they're basically marching again. If you have Lamanites down here, wilderness, Manti, you've got the sort of the wilderness going from sea to sea here. You've got the river valley here, and up here to the, I'm looking at it correctly, to the northeast, you have Bountiful. And the Lamanites are going to push, whereas last time attacking Amalickiah, they were coming up along the Western Sea. Now they're going to go up along the Eastern Seaboard, and their intent is to capture Bountiful, which is a strategic position leading to the North Countries, which would give the Lamanites free access to the North Countries and basically allow them to surround the Nephites in both the North and the South. And this is where we're going to see some of the fiercest battles, and that's what we have happening in the chapter here. Ending famously with Teancum on New Year's Eve sneaking into the tent of Amalickiah and putting a javelin through his heart. And that's the end of the 25th year. So, Martin, I'll throw it back to you for what you've got to say in 51.
A couple of things very quickly in chapter 51. Verse 5 talks about the political philosophy of the kingmen. They want the law to be altered to overthrow free government so that there can be a king over the land. And it's not just a king, it's lack of freedom. That seems to be a key point. And why would they be in favor of a lack of freedom? Well, verse 8, who are these guys? They're the people of high births. So if you're the very people who would be supported by the kingmen, you know, the people of high birth who the kings might tend to favor, you know, the earls and the dukes and the people of position who would get all the wonderful perks and benefits, if you will, from the king who would be in power, then we can start to understand why someone would actually be in favor of this. It's self-absorption and self-centeredness. That's at the core of the whole thing. We see, in some ways, kind of a surprising description in verse 14 of Moroni, but completely understandable. He feels betrayed by the people who he has worked so hard for so many years to defend. And then they don't want to support him. And the very last phrase there in verse 14 says that, and this is talking about Moroni, that his soul was filled with anger against them because of their stubbornness. It's really a tragic thing. Here's somebody who has done so much and he is not supported. So he is angry. So here's an example of, hey, it's okay. The good guys can actually be angry. So, verse 21 finally has some of the king men supporters actually being humbled. About halfway through verse 21, that they were brought down to humble themselves like unto their brethren, and to fight valiantly for their freedom from bondage. And so here we find that necessity perhaps is the mother of invention, to use the oft-used phrase. And we see here that bad ideas have bad results, and these people were brought down and humbled and saw that their ideas weren't so great, and they changed their ways. That's all I have for chapter 51.
I don't think I've got anything more. I'm trying to think if I already said this. Part of the problem is you've got all these cities that are captured by the Lamanites, and now they're getting the advantage of all of Moroni's fortifications. This is why Moroni's, one of the reasons he's so furious, is that the very cities which he has fortified to protect against the Lamanites have now fallen into Lamanite hands, which means it's going to be a long battle, which is what you're going to see as you go through these chapters, to get them back one by one. Chapter 52, you have New Year's Day. The Lamanite army wakes up to find that the king is dead. There have been some excellent articles over the years, including a recent post at Book of Mormon Central, saying why this would be so devastating. New Year's Day was typically the day in which the king sort of went through a fake death and resurrection to show that he was king, he was favored of God, and so on and so forth. And the Lamanites find that Amalekai is dead. And they're stranded. They're all the way up close to Bountiful. So they basically retreat into retreat down to the city of Mulek, get in there. Amalekai's brother is appointed king over the people. He appears to be in the area because it talks about him later leaving the land of Zarahemla to let the queen know what's happened. And it pretty much sums it up. And thus, verse 14, and thus were the Nephites in those dangerous circumstances in the ending of the 26th year of the reign of the judges. A lot of the work that Moroni had spent 4 years preparing for has now been turned against them. And the real risk they have is if the Lamanites capture the entire eastern seaboard, including Bountiful, and then have access to and control the lands northward. The Nephites are in effect surrounded, and they're in real trouble because they have no way of sort of predicting from which direction the Lamanites are going to come for them. And then it sort of says that there you have these, it passes over a couple of years. I mean, it sort of summarizes that you have sort of this a bit like World War One, where you had, you know, a couple of years spent in trenches. You have, these aren't trenches, but what you have is 27th to 28th year, there's this back and forth between the Nephites and Lamanites over trying to capture, recapture these cities, particularly the city of Mulek. And it takes them basically 2 years to recapture the city of Mulek, which could get you an idea of just how badly this is all going for the Nephites. Martin?
Just a couple of quick things. This is fascinating war stratagem here. There's a decoy employed in verse 21 where a small group led by Teancum goes down in full view. And when the Lamanites see this, Jacob, their leader, who has a whole lot more zeal than apparently wisdom, smarts here, says, I'm going to go get these guys. And he leads his army out. And then, of course, Teancum retreats. And then a larger force joins and they fight. And the ultimate result is mentioned in verse 35, where Moroni is wounded. So this was a really tough battle, but Jacob was killed. And this is not a great result for the Lamanites here. And in verse 39, as many who they're asked to deliver up their swords and to stop fighting, and as many as would not were taken prisoner. And so this is a rough result of a really ferocious and horrible war. That's all I have.
And that's pretty much where the lesson leaves off with 52 here, with things dangling in the balance. It's, we're in the middle of a long, prolonged war. It's not clear how this is going to turn out. It's like I said, it's taken them basically 2 years to recapture the city of Mulek. It's not clear exactly where in the second year we are here, but it's taken them at least a year and more like 2 years to recapture it. And meanwhile, by the way, this is all along the eastern, like I said, along the eastern seaboard. Over in the west is where Helaman is going to be leading forces, and this is what lesson 32 is going to talk about Helaman and the stripling warriors. That's going to be taking place over the same period of time over to the west. And when Helaman writes his letter to Moroni, it's after a couple of years of battle, much like this, and it's in a situation where they're lacking for supplies and are wondering what the problem is, but you're going to have to wait for the next roundtable to hear about that. Why did Mormon include these chapters on war? My personal opinion is that Mormon himself probably did a lot of this editing during his 10-year hiatus when he stepped down, refused, you know, Mormon started leading the Nephite armies when he was 15, I believe. But it got the Nephites got so wicked that he stepped down for about 10 years and stopped leading them. And I suspect that's when he did a lot of the research and editing and producing of the Book of Mormon. He had already seen some of the worst that war could do. And he was looking at the root causes and root issues. From his perspective, this was, you know, comparatively, this period among the Nephites that we're studying in Alma was sort of a golden age. You know, you had prophets, the church was there, so on and so forth. There was a church of God established. When Moroni is leading the Nephites, there is very little church presence, and frankly, the Nephites are as vicious And as in Mormon's phrase, without civilization, as the Lamanites themselves. And I think his caution and his lesson is that these are the consequences of unrighteousness in a civilization or a people, is this kind of result. That's a lesson he draws time and again in these chapters, and it's to let us know that this is what we can, you know, we may face if we as a people are not living up to our covenants with the Lord. Martin?
Many people ask why these chapters on war, and I think that the question reveals a lot about the circumstances in which we find ourselves. Throughout most of history, nobody would even ask that question because they themselves would have been embroiled in war or would have known people, family members, who were affected directly by war. The fact that those questions are asked so often by so many shows that despite the turmoil in the world, we live in a time of relative peace and relative safety, for which we should be very, very grateful. Back to you.
That's it for this particular roundtable. We hope you've enjoyed it, that this has been of use for you in preparing your lessons or in your own study of the Book of Mormon. I'm Bruce Webster. This is Martin Tanner. We're with the Interpreter Foundation, and we wish you all a good rest of the day.